Hello, this podcast here is the preparation for a meeting on stage, which I'm doing with Oliver Marks on September 5th, a Friday in San Francisco, 11:30 to 12:15, as part of the Office 2.0 conference. Good morning, Oliver.
How are you? Hi.
Okay. And why don't you start briefly telling people here who you are?
Okay. So I'm an enterprise collaboration consultant, and until recently I was running the collaboration environment inside Sony PlayStation worldwide. Which worldwide, meaning Asia, Europe, and America.
Okay, so Oliver, in this conversation here, will be taking the world of a person who has run inside a large organization, the basically collaboration software. My background, of course, as Amazon's former chief scientist, is that I would take more of the outside view about the customer-centric view, how to actually help customers make decisions. The first question which we're addressing today in this preparation is, how actually is the world changing?
Right, exactly. And what we were just talking earlier in a previous meeting about the challenges for large companies where it's critical that the internal ecosphere and the internal environment in a company accurately reflects the outside world, so that there's a synergy there between the internal community of a company and the external community of customers and the partners and so on, and that there is a nice integration and synergy between those two yins and yangs, if you like, of a company.
So the way I view it is, what has changed in the last 10, 15, 20 years is that the communication costs have dropped dramatically.
Yes.
Consumers are used to talking often, you know, after hours at least, for free to their friends, and people are expecting to be able to use mobile phones to reach their friends without any problem. Now, that bidirectional communication has not really made it into the communication between consumers and companies. So, whereas due to the drop of communication costs, TCP/IP, VoIP, etc., it is possible most organizations internally have actually big problems on catching up with this. Last night, I had dinner with a couple of VC friends, and one of them told me that he was on hold for 2 hours in United, and he described how the first half hour he was furious, then, and after the 2 hours, he just said, please, just talk to me. Just please help me make that reservation. So that's one way of cooking people down. We just put them, maybe put you on hold. No, please, don't put me on hold again. And that's sort of their way of dealing with one case, to just make sure you comply. And after all, some of the airlines have nothing to lose.
Exactly.
However, the companies which we expect to be at Office 2.0 do have stuff to lose, and they do have stuff to gain. So I think one of the questions I want us to think about now is, how can we leverage that dramatic cost in communication? That means the wait times have disappeared. Mm-hmm. Things have become instantaneous or almost instantaneous. What are the good and the bad things about having lost the time constant of waiting for that letter to actually arrive? Secondly, it is possible to have not only one-to-one communication or the broadcasts we had before by, you know, people buying a spot on television, but narrowcasting, where can get your 300 best friends on Facebook to actually listen to what you are saying right now.
Exactly.
So what are the properties of different communication media? IM, short messages, email, blogs, wikis. Do you want to expand a little bit of what you see as the categories which are the axis of the space of communication media which have emerged in the last decade?
Yeah, and I think there's two critical things to add to this conversation. One is that, paradoxically, while communication costs with mobile phones and IM and so on and so forth are getting cheaper and cheaper, flying and driving in cars and gasoline costs are going through the roof. So there's a paradox here that large companies are spending more and more money putting people up in hotels and flying them around just to speak to each other face to face, even as these technologies are dropping in price and becoming more and more efficient. So there is there's a huge vacuum there almost in the way you've got the promise of all of these modern collaborative techniques, and then you've got the enormous expense of traveling and flying around the planet and waiting on hold and having your shoes sniffed by security in airports and on and on and on. The one other point I really want to make is that before you go anywhere near the technologies, there's another huge shift going on, which is the actual strategies and techniques of how you collaborate. And this is true both with collaborating with your customers and with each other, and even to the extent of organizing a dinner party using a wiki, as we were talking about earlier. But when you've got 3,000 people around the world, you have to have clear rules of how and why you do things before you get anywhere near the technology.
That's interesting. What Oliver's referring to, my friend Quentin Lee, filmmaker, is in town tonight, and so I have a cook who cooks for 10 people. And rather than me trying to figure out how to deal with the potential, you know, 50 people who could come, I just put it up on the web, quentinlee.wikipaces.com, and tell people, hey, first come, first serve. And if you don't get in, you can have champagne beforehand with us, or you can come for dessert. But unfortunately, you know, dinner is, you know, that way. So that is this kind of transparency,
yes,
which many companies would not have. Have you not sometimes, you know, heard that, well, I guess I need to invite that person, but I just hope they're not coming. So if I just engineered right, you know, they will not be able to accept. That's not the way in this world where transparency is happening. So this example serves for small groups. And small for me is certainly 50 students in my class at Stanford is a small group where people know each other.
Yeah.
So if you screw up there, then in the next class, somebody will be looking at you in a funny way and saying, that was not the best remark you made. And that is not the case anymore. And at some stage, it flips over. You said 3,000 people. GE, I think, is a company which has huge...
500,000, I think it is.
500,000 employees.
All using the same collaboration system worldwide. And,
okay.
In fact, Dr. Sue Grewal will be speaking at the same conference, Office 2.0, about that very environment.
Okay, so what we have is, one, we talked about the timescales.
Mm-hmm.
Two, we talked about the scope of communication, how many people we are reaching.
Yeah.
The interesting cultures of BCCs and non-BCCs. We probably all have replied to an email once with a funny thing and then got an email back. Andreas, you were in BCC. Gee, what are you doing here? third dimension here is the dimension of basically a change from quantity into quality.
Yeah.
That if you have the basis of in-person interactions, of knowing the people, how can we take that usually more civilized way of interacting to collaboration tools with thousands, 10,000, potentially 100,000 people?
Yeah.
A friend of mine from Stanford who runs a food blog, she lives up in Sacramento, she explains that she views the collaboration tool of her blog like her living room space.
Mm-hmm.
And just if somebody came into a living room and say, peed in the flower pot, she would kindly tell him that that's not the culture she would like to foster in her living room and tell him to please leave.
Right.
And so how do these new ways of interacting evolve? And what you see on Facebook, what you see on MySpace, what you see in many comments on blogs, that people just, you know, say, hey, me too, and stuff like this, maybe, you know, they get some brownie points for participating in a, you know, collaboration. How can one lift in conversations through these media, through these modern social media? Social media for me means sharing stuff. Mm-hmm. How can one lift the level so actually people will achieve things which are very difficult to achieve in other ways?
So I think, yeah, I think one of the key tasks of management here, senior management, is to identify the strategies and tactics to tell people how to do things in a company. Because very few people actually want to use new tools that they're experimenting with without knowing that the management and the people running the company are empowering them and encouraging them to do that. There's a number of issues around that. And what tends to happen in terms of particularly large companies is you get a collaboration environment which is working wonderfully well with 50 people, to pick up Andreas's cue at Stanford, for example. And then people are baffled when the success of the 50-person environment makes them, you know, think, well, great, we'll apply this to 3,000 people now, and then the whole thing falls apart because it hasn't been thought through how to expand that collaboration. And one of the reasons for that is because, essentially, people get into a rut of using a system in a certain way, and you have to basically make them think as transparently as possible to actually use the tools in more constructive and transparent ways.
So transparency for me, as a person who comes from, you know, looking at data and trying to figure out from maybe people's attention what their intentions are, transparency is a good thing.
Yeah.
In my view, it allows companies to, for instance, understand where those bananas would be rotting somewhere, where actually they are rotting, as opposed to, you know, just knowing that they sort of didn't arrive on the shelf, all the way to a bi-directional transparency. Going back to our lovely example of the airline, which is, has a hub in San Francisco, isn't it interesting there's this information asymmetry that I, if I call from a mobile phone, they already know who I am. And they ask me if this is Andreas Weigen or a person speaking on behalf of Andreas Weigen, please press 7585 or whatever it is. Okay. On the other hand, they tend to mumble some name. You have no idea you're talking to. They might record the conversation and they keep the recording. So if it can be used against you, haha, we have a recording. You said you don't want to have a ticket which is upgradable. If, on the other hand, they said, yes, for those $7,000 between San Francisco and Los Angeles in economy, you can upgrade with a system-wide certificate. Well, you show up at the airport and it didn't happen. So transparency, for me, is not a one-way mirror.
Yes.
Transparency should be here a two-way window where you can actually also see inside the organization. So for instance, why don't they, because they do have my email, simply send an MP3 of the conversation to me afterwards for a perusal? Or why don't they save it somewhere and promise it can be accessed for the next year? So what tools do you think might be emerging in this world where storage and communication essentially are free, that empower the customer, that empower the employee within the organization, and actually just makes people more like people, interact like people? That when you have a misunderstanding with a person you know, you sit down and say, you know, I thought 50, you said 15, well, we'll figure it out in some way, have a good glass of wine and both be happy. The asymmetry and the depersonalization, the internal focus of communication, which the Industrial Revolution has brought, is being poked,
nibbled away
by the communication revolution.
Exactly, yes. And I would cite, to follow on from Andreas's point, I'd cite an example of Jive Software, who have a community product. And what's interesting, they have basically an internal community product and an external community product. And the two things do work together. This is one of many solutions in this space, but this is a good example of, let me rewind. I mean, basically, a good relationship as a consumer with a company, talking for a moment as a consumer, is one where you trust that company and you feel you know them very well and you feel that their integrity is very high. And that integrity doesn't come from looking at a whole bunch of adverts on TV or looking at magazine ads or whatever. It comes from your experience with the company. So citing, for example, Apple, their stores are incredibly sort of transparent. I know they're white, but you go into the store and there's nothing there except their products. There are very attentive people who are just there to listen to you and get your views. If you go on the Apple website, everything is completely clear. There's no ambiguity. There's no, you know, sort of, you know, chiseling you for extra amounts of money you didn't realize when you were buying the product online and so on. It's all very, very transparent indeed. And to add to that, there are powerful user communities that go with that. So if I buy an Apple product, I know that I trust the brand's integrity, and I also know that there is a huge online community if I want to type in some information in a community space online, or I can go to a store and talk to a person who is carefully briefed to answer my questions. And I think Apple are really, you know, in my eyes, and admittedly I'm somewhat of a tech person, really at the sort of the very tip of this whole movement. And it's what's interesting about Apple is it's transparent, it's so effective.
Let me contrast this, or let me add to this with two other examples. Mm-hmm. One of them is JetBlue,
yeah,
which a friend of mine just sent me an article that JetBlue apparently, which is very interesting, uses people at home helping other customers. Very interesting concept. The second example is a company called LiveOps, which is based in Santa Clara County here. And LiveOps has about 10,000 people who are at home. And when you, for instance, call the telephone number in a call center on television, 1-888-333-1212, buy your refrigerator now, then chances are you end up at one of these LiveOps people. Mm-hmm. They're all agents, no employees. And right now, the prices are fixed. That I think, let's say, the company who sells refrigerators pays maybe 75 cents a minute, and the woman sitting at home answering the phone pays 25 cents a minute. Now let's push this further. In this day and age, where actually we can measure state, or we can at least indicate state, status, like status updates on Facebook, we now are able to say, gee, you know, if the phone was ringing now in this phone conversation, in this podcast here, then, you know, for a couple of $100 a minute, I would be willing to take the call. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when I'm driving up to Burning Man on Monday, in that case, you know, I'm happy to talk to anybody for free whenever they want to call me.
Yeah.
Give me, you know, some entertainment in the 6-7 hours of drive. So what this shows us is that the old model of not knowing what state the recipient is in, which led to Super Bowl ads, which led to sending out catalogs. On the average, I heard 14 seconds is the time people spend looking at the catalog. Mm-hmm. That world, by people having this bi-directional communications, two-way communication, saying, right now, only disturb me if it's really important. The cost is not infinity, as it would be if you turn off your phone.
Yeah.
But the cost is high. Mm-hmm. And then maybe the sender of this communication should be able to give some metadata, not how important it's for him that you answer the phone, but how important it's for you that you answer the phone.
That's exactly right, yes. And there's another interesting thing here, which is scalability is a very new thing. You know, people working from their homes. I'm going to cite the example of IT, where large companies, I'm sure Amazon is a great example of this. In fact, I think this is one of the reasons for the S3 servers being developed, was because at peak times, i.e. Christmas, you need to have colossal server capacity. Most of the rest of the year, you don't need those servers, but the IT department has to budget for a sort of a worst case scenario of maximum hits. You apply this to humans, basically. It's the same thing at Christmas. You know, you're likely to get the most calls needed for support, and you have a very scalable community of people working from their homes helping customers. This could, I haven't actually thought about this in detail before, but this could be interesting internally in companies as well, if you're ramping up on training or whatever.
And what I love about this example here is that it truly nibbles away on this old metaphor of I am inside and you're outside.
Yeah.
Because that JetBlue agent who answered the phone call, well, they are sort of kind of, you know, neither inside nor outside.
Yeah.
Secondly, it nibbles away on that old notion of 9 to 5, because first of all, some people might want to call in the evening, someone should be available, but it's more important when the person feels like working, and that could be potentially more than the 8 hours a day, or it could be less than the 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
They feel like working, and only due to the emergence of this collaboration tools,
yeah,
is it possible to actually make sure that on the one hand we have people, on the other hand, we don't have spare capacity. Collective intelligence, just as a small interlude, comes in 3 flavors. And that is some of the things which we talked about at the Foo Camp, the Collective Intelligence Foo Camp at Google in the beginning of this year. First flavor is that of just decomposing tasks. Mm-hmm. And decomposing tasks means I need to check 1,000 entries for restaurants, and I, you know, put them out, and I pay each person checking for a restaurant a quarter, and then I put it back together. The second notion is that of a portfolio approach. So portfolio is, of course, from Wall Street, how you reduce risk given the same expected value, or for a certain risk level, how you increase the expected return. So the portfolio approach means you have a bunch of people doing things in parallel, and then you get a feeling about where might be the errors. And just like if you have 5 stocks, one of the square of 5 is your error bar is going down. If you have 5 people doing the same task, if they all do the same, you can be more sure that the answer is the right one than if they do different, come up with different answers. The first one was decomposition. Second one was this parallel approach or the portfolio approach. The one which we want to talk about here is what I call the collaboration approach, the collaboration approach to collective intelligence, where people actually interact with each other.
Right.
And here, my dinner wiki for Quentin Lee is a beautiful example because first come, first serve. It's not the most exciting interaction, but hey, since people know each other, I could actually see that one might hit up the other and say, hey, dude, can you let me go to the dinner and, you know, I'll buy you a bottle of champagne or something like this. And that informal interactions is impossible to do in a world where you try to centralize it to some bottleneck. I would be on the phone now where people call me as opposed to talking to you.
Very inefficient, exactly. Yeah. Rewinding very, very quickly. The other pillar which is crumbling in the old work paradigm is email. And Andreas discussed this before, and I've discussed this before. What's interesting about email is people still use email in the way they use postal mail, which is archaic. I mean, it's a Victorian paradigm. And what's interesting is mail breaks at a certain point. It doesn't matter whether envelopes are coming through your letterbox. After a certain point, you don't have enough time in the day to open all of those paper envelopes, take out the content and read them. The same thing is true with email. So a lot of people, ironically, at this point, literally right now as we're speaking, are sitting in cubicles with a fluorescent tube light over their head, working on email. I mean, the email's flowing in and they're going through it like a battery chicken or something. And the tragedy is that, you know, basically so much of this communication is one-to-one or one plus three BCCs, and you have email with endless iterations of a document, so people are scrabbling around trying to find which is the latest version of a spreadsheet or a Word document attached. I mean, this is insane. And it doesn't scale, and it basically, I think, literally makes people ill after a certain point because they can't cope with it. The alternative, in very simplistic terms, are the wikis and the collaboration tools, which Andreas is talking about with his dinner party, where, you know, many hands make light work, and the transparency, which is, you know, which becomes apparent when people are working in an open collaborative space, is incredibly powerful and also incredibly empowering because people get all of the dynamics of how something is actually unfolding, whether it's a dinner party or a work project or some task that your manager has given you that you don't quite understand. When it's in a collaboration environment, it's transparent. You can see all of the dialogue and you can chip in and ask questions.
The interesting thing is that not necessarily modern companies like Facebook actually embrace internally those things. And for example, if you talk to a bunch of people and maybe you set up the meetings on a wiki, you might still get back that email from, you know, some leader who decides to talk for everybody saying, I have talked to the group members and this is the result I want to inform you of. I mean, it's there you see that. On the one end, it's about relationships. That's the great thing about Facebook. It's about, you know, people producing content, people talking to each other. But do they, going back to the topic of FS2O, do they, and I just use this as a random example here, do they internally reflect on and embrace what they're doing externally? For instance, Amazon does a super job in everybody at Amazon uses Amazon.com just the way any end user uses it. And that helps innovation because a good number of features there came from some developer thinking, oh, I could improve on that, and just whipping it up, A-B testing it, and if it's good, it's in. In contrast to this, some, I apologize for the repeated example of airlines, have actually, even in their e-commerce team, people who basically never use the site for their own bookings because they have their own website for staff travel.
Yeah.
So in terms of innovation in the company, I think getting people to really enjoy what they're doing for the end user, to really think about it constantly, to be user-centric means to use it themselves and means to be enabled to reflect upon their usage and to be empowered to actually do something about it if there's some idea.
I think that's absolutely perfect. There's an interesting thing about that business with the airlines, that people know, you know, first through relatives, that there's an inside secret way of getting tickets if you're an employee. So you get this weird dynamic building up of people knowing that there's a sort of a back route to the back end of the company, which is the opposite of transparency. And interestingly, the car companies last year or at the beginning of this year were running TV ads saying, you know, you get the workers' rate. I can't remember what the term is, but they're actually saying, you know, you get the factory rate. because that's clearly seen, even on an advertising level for cars, which trucks, which nobody wants to buy at the moment, that you're sort of giving them the secret sauce of what the inside people in the company get. But that's so wrong, because I'm a huge car guy personally. Just to switch gears quickly, I collect old cars, and the more I know about a car company, Andreas is driving now. the more I know about a car company and the way it works. It's the old thing I was saying earlier. The more confidence I have in them, the more I feel I'm part of their culture, and the more I can sort of go on forums and discuss things and so on and so forth. And the more there's a sort of an advertising sheen to the company, but there's no dialogue between me and that company, the less of a connection I make with them.
Alrighty, so this ends part one, the first 25 minutes of our podcast. In part two, we'll be talking about data strategy, we'll talk about incentive design, and we'll revert back and come back to the topic between the inside of corporations and the outside, and how to genuinely create opportunities for feedback by customers, and how do you listen to the customers.